Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and I'm, of course, joined by Frank. What's going on, Frank?
Doing well. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. We are joined by Charles de Lauzerica. He's a USC film school grad, and Charles is best known as one of the premier Blu-ray and DVD content producers working in the business. He's produced making-of documentaries for the works of David Lynch, Sam Raimi, James Cameron, Jean-Pierre Jeunet, David Fincher, Michael Bay, the Coen brothers, and rather notably, Ridley and Tony Scott. Ridley has actually been having Charles create behind-the-scenes content for his features and for the special edition Blu-rays and DVDs for over the last 15 years. And on top of that, Charles is also an accomplished filmmaker in his own right. In 2012, he released the stylish and very intense and award-winning indie thriller Crave, which was an auspicious debut, and hopefully it signals some more feature films in the future. And he rather famously produced the Alien Quadrilogy box set, which is one of the most intense, the coolest Blu-ray DVD packages that has ever been released, while also supervising the restorations of the new cuts of Alien 3, Blade Runner, the final cut, and Ridley Scott's Legend. He's a multiple Saturn Award winner, and from what we can tell, a huge and passionate movie buff. So we want to say welcome to the show, Charles, and it's a pleasure to get you on here to chat with you today about your career.
Thanks for having me. I've heard a lot about you guys, so I'm always, I'm always excited to talk about movies and life and stuff. So we'll do that, hopefully.
Awesome. Can't wait. I'm sure Nick does as well, but I just wanted to say I own the Alien Quadrilogy on Blu-ray, and thank you for that, because that thing is incredible.
Thanks. Did you get the Alien Anthology Blu-ray set, though?
The Alien Anthology Blu-ray set.
That's the one that's really super loaded. I mean, that's so much more than the Quadrilogy DVD set.
Oh, no.
I'm pretty
I don't know.
Sure.
Let me look.
Okay. Just curious.
Let me look. I may have to go to Amazon and buy it then. Yeah, I know I have this one, the Alien Anthology Blu-ray set, right?
That's the huge mother load edition that has everything.
Yeah, that's the one I have.
Great.
Yeah, my parents were nice enough to get me the Quadrilogy DVD and then the Anthology Blu-ray, so they double dipped for me, so hopefully you got the nickel or whatever the hell they give you there.
Oh, I get no back end, but I'm just thrilled that you have the correct version of the movie. That's all I care about.
Yep, both of us do. Awesome.
The Alien box set is something else. For people that don't have it, it really is something that any movie fan should own. It's a beautiful box set, thick sort of cardboard DVD, Blu-ray holders with wonderful images that have been put together. And the special features on this stuff is just insane. I mean, you get one of the greatest making of documentaries, which is the Alien, in my opinion, the Alien 3 making of, which is just one of the most comprehensive, eye-opening sort of looks at, what happens when a film is going through all sorts of turmoil. I guess because this is one of your biggest things, maybe we can talk about this to lead off. What was did you feel this overwhelming sense of importance when you were asked to put together first the Quadrilogy and then the Anthology, considering how iconic these films are for so many people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've long been a huge fan of the Alien films. My mom took me to see Alien opening day at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood in 1979. So I was probably I was 9 years old. And that scarred me for life, but in the best way, in the best way possible. So it was funny because when I started working with Ridley and Tony Scott, I was a big fan of their work and their filmmaking. And I didn't really plan on doing the DVD Blu-ray content producing job. I mean, I had no ambition for that. But when Ridley asked me to supervise the first Alien DVD release in 1999, that began this whole journey, which every once in a while, every several years, tends to bring me back to Alien somehow. So, you know, after the 99 release, then I went back to, in 2002 and 2003 to work on the quadrilogy. And then 7 years after that, pretty much did the anthology Blu-ray stuff. So it just kind of, like, I believe there's a line in Alien 3 where Ripley says, "I can't remember a time when you weren't in my life," regarding the alien. And I think that these boxes are kind of the same thing for me. I mean, I love them. And there's always new things to explore with Alien and all four movies and now the ongoing saga. But I definitely felt the weight of the importance of it. And I think that's why I almost like fanatically kept adding more and more stuff and building it out every time. Every time they give me a chance, I always try to add, you know, more new material.
Yeah, and that's one of my favorite sets I own. And then I still have my Blade Runner DVD set, the briefcase set, which I believe you did that one too. Yes, I hope
I did. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, the briefcase set is amazing. It's up on my media center right now.
Oh, thanks. I know so many people that have this inexplicable silver briefcase in their homes, and most people don't even know what it is, but, you know, fans do. So I'm glad that you have one.
Mine's sitting upstairs in my office. Oh, yeah. That was a Christmas gift. I think that I might have I have to really look, but I think I might have almost every version of Alien, I'm sorry, Blade Runner, that was made available in America. I couldn't attest to any of maybe the Region 2s or, you know, the European releases, what have you. But, I mean, I've got, like, that original Snapper Case DVD. That was one of the first things I ever bought for DVD. That movie just was so – my father took me to see Blade Runner on the big screen at a revival cinema at a local college in the town where I grew up. And I was probably 10 when I saw it, 10 or 11. And that movie really set into motion, like, my early love for cinema, and it totally blew me away. I had no idea what the hell I was watching for most of the film. But I just knew that it was something important. It was something massive. So I can only imagine what it must be like for you to be sort of involved on the ground level of a restoration of a film like Blade Runner and, you know, getting a chance to, you know, see stuff that, you know, even the biggest fans could only dream of.
Blade Runner is my favorite movie. And so, you know, working on it, I mean, every day was like Christmas, basically. I just opening new boxes of stuff and seeing like lost footage and screen tests and all these great sort of like gems of Blade Runner history that had been on the shelf for literally decades and thought to be lost, you know? So, I mean, it was probably the hardest project I ever worked on, but also the most like fun and enjoyable and, you know, rewarding, I would say.
How did you know, just sort of give people a background, how did you get your start? I mean, I know I read the intro, but, you know, where did the love for cinema begin? And, you know, I know you said that you never once thought about how you never once sort of saw yourself getting into the behind the scenes content, you know, world, but sort of how did, you know, what was the progression for Charles?
Well, I mean, I was at USC Film School and, you know, I think a lot of the students there are maybe overly optimistic about their chances of becoming a big time director right out of the gate. And I had applied to USC Film School and I didn't get accepted to the film school. I got accepted to USC, but not the film school. So I was kind of in limbo there for a little over a year as I kept trying to get in. And I finally did get into the film school, but that was sort of the wake up call that maybe, you know, this path to movie making glory wasn't going to be as easy as I think a naive young kid thought. So immediately when I was at film school, I started interning for a lot of different companies. And one of the companies I interned for was Scott Free, Ridley and Tony Scott's company. And I began just doing, you know, the menial kind of intern work. And then they had me read scripts and do script coverage and notes for Ridley and Tony. And then that evolved into, you know, more development work. And so that was like, you know, like probably like 4 or 5 years of doing that before DVD was even on the radar. So and I only got that job because I was collecting DVD, you know, just voraciously when it first came out. I think every Tuesday I'd go and just load up on a ton of discs. And of course, in those early days, a lot of the real classics that we love weren't readily available quite yet in DVD. The studios were sort of hedging what titles came out in which order, and certain filmmakers wanted to withhold their titles a bit until there was a bigger user base. So basically, I just heard through the grapevine, the Digital Biz website reported that Fox had begun working on the Alien DVD box set for the first four movies. And I just basically just let Ridley know. I just wanted to like make him aware of it. And he wasn't even 100% up to speed on DVD. So I gave him a full briefing on what it was and what it was capable of, and the, you know, enhanced picture and sound quality and the interactivity and the menus and all that stuff. And, he was leaving to go shoot Gladiator, and he basically just turned to me and asked, can you be in charge of this while I'm gone? And I said, sure. You know, just thinking it was like yet another task I was doing for him. And then it kind of evolved into this, you know, the last like 17 years, I think, or so of doing this type of work.
Well, yeah, it's just like, yeah, sure, you know, Ridley Scott, hey, why don't you just take care of this for me? I love it, you know, I love it. And one of the things that Ridley has done so well, obviously, besides making the films themselves, but he's really put together some of the best, I mean, had you put together some of the best Blu-rays that have come out over the years. He's been one of these filmmakers that truly has embraced the format, whereas I think that maybe some are reluctant to do so because their, you know, their time is valuable or whatever. But, you know, he's one of the biggest guys in Hollywood, and seemingly he's got all the time in the world to put these things together for people who love this sort of stuff, of which there's many. So,
yeah, no, I mean, yeah, thanks. I think that, you know, Ridley's always interested in being sort of on the cutting edge and being, you know, very forward thinking in his films and how they're presented. And, you know, he had, for instance, when he did Prometheus, that was his first 3D movie, and he had no problem jumping into 3D. It was almost like he should have been doing it years earlier. He just jumped into it so naturally. So I think that anytime there's some kind of new technology or something at the forefront of filmmaking, I think he's always interested. And because DVD was a great way to preserve his catalog titles as well as present his new films, it just seemed like, you know, a really great format to embrace, and that naturally evolved into Blu-ray, and you know, and then here we are today.
Yeah, I can't think of how many films I own that probably have been done by you. I mean, my two most cherished sets obviously are my Alien and Blade Runner. So when you put that together, are you involved in like the menus as well and like the actual physical media of it, or is it more of a behind the scenes content of arranging it?
Well, every project is slightly different. There's no two that are the same. In the case of Blade Runner and the Alien sets, yeah, I was involved in the menus very directly, especially in the case of Alien quadrilogy and anthology. I was very, very involved with those because I was working, in the case of the anthology, with Raleigh Stewart, who, you know, came up with those really great sort of Weyland-Yutani style, you know, future graphics. That have yet that kind of retro glitchy look to them.
Right.
And he and I had a plan, which was we wanted to include a lot of sort of Easter eggs and what we called geek proof, like metadata in the graphics. So like anytime you would see, like a, you know, the layout of a Nostromo or a, you know, a pulse rifle or whatever it was from any of the movies, whatever supplemental data there was in the menus, you know, we worked on that together to make sure it was accurate. And in the case of Alien 3, we even took a bit trying to explain where the egg came from at the beginning of Alien 3. So we kind of show, we did this kind of like surveillance video of the queen hatching an egg in the landing skid kind of bay of the dropship from Aliens, rather. You know, again, it doesn't really make sense, but so many fans are like, where did that egg come from in Alien 3? So we created like this, you know, alien alert that there's something on the ship, and here's our little, you know, kind of glitchy video version of it. So it's like, that was the fun part of it. You know, after all the bonus content is done, after the documentaries are done, and after all the other goodies are put together, that's always fun to get into the menus and try to come up with a meaningful experience that doesn't take away from the movies, but supports them. And you know what it is? It's like going to Disneyland and you're waiting in line before the ride, and the ride is like maybe it's an hour wait. So what do you do for that hour? You know, you don't just stand there in the middle of the park. You're in this immersive environment. You're going further and further and deeper into Space Mountain or Indiana Jones or Star Tours, whatever it is. You're just going deeper and deeper into it, and you're getting immersed in the world. So that's how I like to look at the menus. It's sort of like the wait in line for the show to begin.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I some of my favorite things with Blu-rays and how they've advanced are menus. And I mean, I think the menus for Alien Quadrilogy is, or I should say Anthology. Which one is it? The Blu-ray? Yeah, that one's incredible.
Yeah,
the Anthology. So, are you somewhat responsible for the Prometheus, the bridging of the gap between the Alien world and the Blade Runner world?
Yeah, I am. I wrote that. I wrote that little.
Yes. Bit.
But you know, it's the funny thing. So many people freaked out when they saw that. So many fans thought, "Oh my God, that's gospel. That's canon. We now have a bridge between the Alien universe and the Blade Runner universe." And it was really meant as a, you know, just a little joke, you know. I mean,
it's breaking my heart.
No, I mean, it's not that. Look, you can. Here's the great thing about Ridley's future worlds is that he just sets them up for you to like explore on your own, you know. And it's like, if you want to believe it, I think you're free to believe it. The same way that if you want to believe Deckard is a replicant, fine. If you don't want to believe it, that's fine too. It's just like it's for you to explore and to consider and to think about. So. And if you watch the enhancement pods on Prometheus, there's one pod that's called Merging Ridley Verses, because there was a moment when one of the mercenary, you know, kind of like bodyguards for Wayland was going to be named Batty. And we show in that pod, we show the conceptual art of the mercenary, and it's clearly Rutger Hauer's face, and it says Batty on his nameplate. So, I mean, that was an idea that was seriously considered, but I think it was just one step too far into geekdom.
Right. You know what? Because, like, the whole Prometheus, Blade Runner, or I should say Alien universe and Blade Runner universe crossover on that Prometheus Blu-ray totally had me thinking for the Blade Runner sequel that I was, like, I convinced myself that Guy Pearce is going to be his character from Prometheus, but at the correct age he was in the web advertisement, or I should say the web video. Yeah. Where he's addressing that huge arena of people, and he may have like a cameo or maybe a brief antagonist or the main antagonist for Blade Runner 2. So I just got to say, as a movie nerd and huge geek, when it comes to stuff, I thought that the Prometheus Blade Runner or the Alien Blade Runner crossover was amazing.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. It's meant to be a little minor bit of entertainment. It's not meant to be taken too seriously. But again, you're more than welcome to take it as seriously as you want.
Awesome. I appreciate it, because I've been taking it seriously for, I don't know, the last however many years the Blu-ray's been out. But that's cool.
Yeah.
No, I get it. Yeah. But that's awesome. That's way cool that you're responsible for that. That's amazing.
Well, the funny thing was is that, you know, Ridley's commercial company, RSA, they produced those viral videos for Prometheus. And, you know, we obviously Fox and everyone wanted to include them on the Blu-ray, but Fox had the idea, wouldn't it be great to have some sort of narrative framework in which to work them in? So it's not just a menu that says play all or watch these clips, where it's more like they were embedded in the universe somehow. So I was tasked with writing these sort of like journal entries for Wayland before the mission. And that just happened to be one of them where we you know, we're talking about artificial like robotics and artificial intelligence, and kind of like I got to thinking, okay, so Wayland is all into robotics. You would think that maybe in the future there'd be other ways of approaching, you know, artificial life. And then I got to thinking about replicants, and I looked at the timeline, and the timeline seemed to work out fairly well to match Tyrell,
right.
Tyrell as a mentor figure for Wayland. And I just went from there, you know. And given that Prometheus kind of got into some religious themes and subtext, it was very easy to work that into Blade Runner's themes and subtext. So it's like I think Ridley definitely has some themes and things he likes to re-explore and include in his films. And that was very easy to bridge the two. It was almost too easy, but it was fun.
So on stuff like on recent stuff like Prometheus, and I believe that I know you probably can't talk too much about it, but like on The Martian, how much are you on set? You know, I know you're going to do your interviews, but how much time do you get to spend on set? And you know, are you a fan of that part of the process more than you are when you're putting it all together, sort of in the edit bay or in your office kind of thing? How do the experiences compare?
Well, you know, again, it's interesting. Every one of them is different. I mean, there were some projects like Prometheus where I spent a huge amount of time on set, and not only on set but in pre-production. I mean, I started documenting Prometheus well over a year before shooting even began. I mean, I was in early meetings with Ridley and the conceptual artists and the creature designers, you know, far before shooting began. So I have a huge amount of footage to draw.
Yeah, the making of that is huge.
Yeah, so it was easy, you know, to make this really detailed, epic doc on Prometheus. But that's not always the case. Sometimes I'm not on set that much or at all, as in the case with The Counselor, for instance, because The Counselor, Ridley works so fast. He's always got another movie going as you're trying to finish the previous one. And because The Counselor was a smaller film, and it was just there wasn't quite the need for the kind of geeky details you get into as you would with a science fiction film, you know, or a war film or something where there's a lot of technology or special effects. It just didn't demand my presence, and I was better off staying here to work on things like Prometheus or the other projects that were happening at the time. So, you know, sometimes I'm there on The Martian. I was there quite a bit, but it's just it depends on the film that you're working on. Every one of them is different. Sometimes it's a lot of fun to be on set. Sometimes it's a slog. Sometimes it's great to be back here and just cutting things together in LA. Other times, you know, you're just going through boxes looking for things and coming up empty. And you know, I've never had the same experience twice in any of these jobs. I really haven't. Every one of them is so different. Which is, by the way, that's what makes the job kind of fun, frankly, is like you're always having a new experience with it, even if it's the same basic process and the same basic types of content. The details of each job are pretty different from the last.
Jeez, man. As a movie nerd myself, you have what sounds like a dream job.
Yeah, it's like totally insane.
I know.
It's like, you know, I just can't imagine being given boxes of like, you know, like random oddities from Blade Runner to be like, you know, sift through these. Let's see what's in here. I mean, it's just crazy.
But yeah, I mean, and there's different parts of the dream job that are really sometimes surreal and fascinating. Like in the case of Prometheus, I mean, every time I've had to put together content for the original Alien, you know, there's precious few minutes of behind the scenes footage from Alien, like 16 millimeter film footage. I mean, I think we've pretty much used, you know, most of whatever Fox had, I think probably all of it. And I always had this fantasy of if only I had a time machine, I would go back to 1978 and 79 and document Alien the way you would document a movie now, the same way I'd go back in time to Blade Runner and document that the way we would document a movie now. So being on the set of Prometheus, it was almost like I got to do that. I almost got to live that out in a way because it was basically an Alien movie. And I could treat Prometheus as I would Alien or Blade Runner if I could go back in time and document those. So when I'm on the set, when I'm on the Bond stage at Pinewood, and you know, you walk in there and there's this massive, massive soundstage, and at the center of it is the space jockey chair, you know, recreated for Prometheus. I mean, that's pretty surreal. And that's a major, you know, what you'd call a geek-gasm, you know, where you just go in and you think, oh man, how did I get here and how lucky am I to be here and that I get to, like, you know, sit in this thing, have my picture taken with it. And it's just so much fun to like realize that, you know, it is a geek dream come true. It really is.
And to not be financially responsible in a way. I can only – not that Ridley has really ever had too many problems with his, you know, with box office and all that kind of stuff, but I am blown away by just the scope and scale and size of some of these productions and the seeming lack of limitations. Prometheus, really, I loved it so much. And, you know, some people have their comments about does it fit into the, you know, the whole world and what is the ending about. I thought the whole thing was just wonderful. I thought that it was an introspective science fiction action film. And I'm really anxious to see where he goes for the next entry, because I know it's been rumored that, you know, he's going to have some sort of direct involvement with Prometheus 2. So I can only imagine sort of where the story is going to explode, you know, from here.
Yeah, that's supposed to go into production, I think, the end of this year. I know, from what I understand, he chose to do that one over Blade Runner 2. I don't know, that's...
Yeah,
what
I tend to shy away from talking about the upcoming things a bit. You might notice, but I
it's all good.
But yeah, Ridley is not directing Blade Runner 2. But I that's, you know, he can only, you know, there's so many movies you can make at a given time.
Right.
So,
and they've got a great guy, you know, sitting at the helm of Blade Runner 2, in my estimation, with Denis Villeneuve. The work I've seen from him has been fantastic. Sicario looks very hard hitting, and, you know, can only imagine sort of what he'll bring to, you know, to that world.
I think he's an excellent director, and I'm really excited. Yeah. They're far worse choices you could make. And actually, I think he's probably one of the absolute best and most interesting directors to go for with a movie like a Blade Runner sequel, because Blade Runner itself is so unique and strange, mm-hmm. its own logic. And I think people nowadays think Blade Runner 2 is going to be nothing but, like, you know, shootouts and spinner chases and explosions, because that's the way people are watching movies these days. And you have to remember, Blade Runner is like this really moody, slow noir, and his films are like that. I mean, his films are very dark and measured, and I think he's exactly the right type of director to do it.
Huge fan of Enemy, and I think that if half of the cerebral nature of Enemy is carried over to, you know, into this sort of blockbuster, quote unquote, I think that people will be really, really spellbound. You know, the opportunities seem so high with who they're getting on in front of the camera and behind the camera. My expectations are getting, you know, very peaked.
Yeah, no, same here. I mean, especially, you know, Roger Deakins shooting it. I mean, I imagine it's just gonna be mind blowing to see.
Right. Yeah. I don't know what I'm more excited for, Blade Runner 2 or the Prometheus sequel. Because I mean, I know that there was there wasn't backlash, but there was criticism over Prometheus, which I think honestly is unwarranted, because I thought Prometheus was genius, because, you know, I love the whole downplay of this isn't an alien prequel. It's like, well, okay, the trailer's the same. You know, it's like the same music, the brooding music and the font and the way that the letters show up, which is great. But I mean, I loved how it was constructed as this film that was so complex and like you touched upon before, with like this religious narrative or undertone to it, which I thought was brilliant. I mean, I couldn't get enough of that. And I mean, after I saw the film, I was fascinated with it. And I kept reading about it, and I kept rewatching it when it came out on Blu-ray, because I was so fascinated by it. But I think that's probably the most genius and original way I've seen a quote-unquote prequel made.
Well, I mean, that's the great thing about a heavily divisive film like Prometheus, is that people keep talking about it. And the more they talk about it, the more they consider it, the more they want to, you know, get under the hood of it and try to figure it out, like figure out why they liked it or why they didn't like it. And that kind of engagement you don't get with a lot of movies that everyone sort of agrees on as being a good film or bad film. I mean, there's a lot of consensus on, I think, most of the big sort of Hollywood, you know, blockbuster movies these days, because they're designed kind of like to be just pure entertainment. And then when you have an artist like Ridley go in and he makes the film on a huge canvas, as you would with a big Hollywood blockbuster, but then he brings his own artistry and kind of, you know, funky stuff to it, that creates a very unique experience, which I think is worth revisiting, whether you liked it or you didn't like it. You just want to keep going back to it and try to figure out what makes it tick.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, because I feel, and we'll step away from Prometheus for a second, but your work on the comprehensive nature of the Alien 3 making of is extraordinary. And not only is it just from a nuts and bolts level extraordinary, but a lot of times it's no secret that Alien 3 was a troubled production. It had any number of issues. Neither Frank or I are filmmakers, so we can only attest to what we read, see, and hear in articles and these behind-the-scenes stuff. A lot of times people don't want to talk about a film that caused them heartache or annoyance or irritation. And the candid nature of the Alien 3 behind the scenes interviews and the construction of that documentary was just amazing. And I just wanted to ask how hard it was to get those people involved and how, if it was challenging to get them to open up to discuss the various issues that went on with that film. You know, I'm assuming that most people who listen to this podcast, you know the tortured backstory of Alien 3, multiple directors hired and fired, David Fincher comes in, a half-completed screenplay, yada, 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 the whole deal. Was it a stressful idea to sort of try to put this thing together? How were you able to pull together all the ingredients to make that documentary?
Well, I mean, it's interesting because it sort of all began before even the quadrilogy set was coming together, because Fox was they were looking to have me do what they used to have, this series of discs called the Five Star Collection on DVD, and, mm-hmm. and they had done Die Hard and Speed and a bunch of other movies, but
they had a bunch of those.
Yeah, and so they wanted me to do an Alien Five Star set, and I kept going back to them because at that point I felt like we'd already tackled Alien pretty well, and to go right back into it again with a five star I thought was maybe unnecessary. But I'm happy to do what they want me to do. I just point out, I would tell them, of the four movies, the one that really needs the special edition treatment is Alien 3. And I kept explaining why that was, because it has such a juicy backstory, and because there's alternate versions of the movie, and now that Fincher is a big director, it's like there's so many aspects that are worth exploring. And they very politely like nodded and smiled and said, well, we'll think about it, but how about Alien? And so we had this round and round for it was almost like 2 years, I think, of can we do Alien Five Star? And then I would ask, can we do Alien 3, special edition or something? And it was always like good natured. It was never like contentious. We weren't like, bartering over this. It was just sort of like we were trying to figure out the best way forward. And then one day, Sven Davison, who used to work at Fox, he basically said, how would you like to do all four? And then that's when my mind was blown. It's almost like, be careful what you wish for, because now I had to do what I was proposing for Alien 3. I now had to do it for all four of the movies. So, but in doing that, it kind of opened the floodgates in terms of Fox's enthusiasm to like let us run and, not just put together the documentary materials, but also put together these extended cuts of three of the movies, because Aliens had already had a special edition on Laserdisc. So that was fine. That was good to go. But the other three needed, sort of comparable companion extended cuts to go with their versions. And of all those three, Alien 3 was by far the most elaborate and the most in need of a significant restoration and research into what the cut was, mostly because Fincher passed on being involved. I mean, we tried so hard to get them. What's that?
No, I was going to say, I mean, it's like he's the only one that's not there, obviously, you know what I mean? And I guess it's sort of not – I guess I wasn't surprised that maybe he didn't get involved because, again, not a filmmaker – had to have probably been a pretty, crushing experience for him in some way to step into a situation like that on your first film, from what I've read and come to understand.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt. It was a tortured production, and I'm sure a lot of people had, very stressful or traumatic experiences on it. And Fincher probably being at the focus point of a lot of that because he was this young director on his first film, but you also have to understand he was an incredibly accomplished commercial and music video director. He probably had more camera time than most feature directors do.
Yeah.
Even at this stage of his career. So, he was highly experienced coming in and enormously talented. So I'm sure he thought that he was a perfect fit for it. And then you also look at the first two Alien movies. Ridley came off The Duelists, this little European Napoleonic era, kind of drama. You wouldn't think, oh, let's give him a science fiction monster movie. Jim Cameron had come off Terminator, which that's definitely more of a match for Aliens, but still he was, a fairly new director. So it wasn't like Fincher was that new in comparison to Ridley or Cameron when they began. So Yeah, I mean, I imagine he definitely had very, you know, hurt feelings over how it went down, especially because I know he was so invested, being a big fan of the first film, he was so invested in trying to make it special.
And with his bold decisions that he made with the, you know, with his feature. One of the things I've always loved about, and I've always been a big fan of Alien 3, like, well, that movie was released in theaters in what, the summer of 92, 93, 91? What, would you, I'm trying to remember exactly off the top of my head.
May of 92.
92. Yeah. So I was 12 years old, saw it in the theater with my father opening night. And this is before I, you know, there was, I was 12 years old in Connecticut. I didn't know about any behind the scenes problems. I sat down and watched the movie with my dad as a 12 year old. My dad was, you know, however old he was, we both really enjoyed it. So I've never had this sort of disdain that so many people have for Alien 3. And I've had a chance to watch all the various cuts. They're all interesting in their own way. But one of the things I've always loved about the Alien series is that they are truly a filmmaker driven franchise. They all feel very different from one another. They explore similar themes, but the aesthetic quality to all four movies, and then if you including Prometheus 5, they're all so different from one another, but yet they still live and breathe in the same world. And that's one of the things I love so much about the Alien films.
It's like a film festival, really. It's like you're going and seeing all of these different films that are all thematically similar, but all from different directors, with the exception of Prometheus. But even Ridley's Prometheus, it seems like it's from a different director than the Ridley who made Alien. You know, So I love the diversity of the Alien films. I think it's to be celebrated.
I do too, and I wanted to talk about yourself as a filmmaker as well, because in addition to all of the behind the scenes content that you're, you know, producing for other great filmmakers, you've had a chance to make a feature as well, a film called Crave, which I recommend that people check out. It's a very stylish, really intense sort of in a way a precursor to something like, you know, Nightcrawler or something like that. It sort of lives and breathes in that same intense, you know, deconstruction of, you know, social values. How did Crave come about and you know, getting a chance to make your first film, something that you want to do more of, like just sort of how did it come about?
Yeah. Well, really quick, just in regards to Nightcrawler, which, you know, came out a couple of years after Crave, which I really enjoy. I thought Nightcrawler was great, and I thought, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal was fantastic. And I call Nightcrawler a successful Crave, because that's kind of what it is. It just Crave. Yeah. It just made a ton more money. But Crave was in the works for a long time, because I've been wanting to direct films since I was 7 years old, and you know, there's so many different sidetracks in my life that it never came my way, or I couldn't find my way to it, or whatever. But I had been trying to develop a first feature for many, many years and had some close calls, but ultimately it came down to when I worked on Blade Runner, I got to become very friendly with Philip K. Dick's family, with the estate, and his daughter, Issa Dick Hackett. She is in charge of the film side of the estate. So basically all of Philip K. Dick adaptations go through her on their way to becoming movies. And she's usually a producer on all of those. So you know, we had struck up a really strong friendship, and I suggested to her, I said, look, I'd love to get back into the directing thing. Maybe I can make a short film based on one of your dad's short stories. And she said, absolutely. So she gave me 5 to choose from. And then I found a 6th, which is the one I really wanted to do. And that developed over such a long period of time. It actually developed out of being a short film and into becoming a feature film. And it was really ambitious. I mean, and we're still trying to get it made. It's just it's a pretty big canvas for what is a very intimate and powerful character drama. But she came to me at one point as we were developing it. She said, you know, it's going to be really difficult to raise this kind of money for a first-time director. Would you mind trying to do something smaller, quicker, faster, like soon, to kind of help convince people that you're, you know, capable of directing it? So that's where Crave came about. My neighbor at the time, Rob Lawton, is a filmmaker, and he had just made his first film. And I went to him and I asked him, I said, do you have anything that's, you know, lean and mean and down and dirty and something we can make fast. And he said, well, I've got this idea. It's Walter Mitty meets Travis Bickle. And I thought, okay, that's pretty cool. That's an interesting idea. Yeah. And so we developed that over like a year, and then, you know, it just took forever even to get the small, quick, you know, easy film took forever, and it was hard, and it was a pain in the ass. It was just like, it was nothing that it was supposed to be, but I got it done. I got it made. And that was sort of, you know, I'm glad I got to like jump into the deep end with that smaller film, because it was, I made a lot of mistakes that I've learned from, and I can't wait to make the next one to try to, you know, learn from those mistakes. But on the whole, I felt pretty happy with the experience. And on the whole, I mean, look, the reaction at film festivals was tremendous. I was really relieved, frankly, that people didn't hate the movie. So that was nice. It's been a very interesting evolution from making this film, you know, kind of like almost grassroots, where we shot for, you know, a certain number of weeks, and then we were missing one scene, and we didn't get to do that scene for 10 more months. And then we did that scene, and then we're like editing for a year and a half, and then visual effects had to come in. And it was just when you're working on an indie level at that, you know, kind of like where you're just trying to like scrape it together on your own, it takes forever. But, I got to say, I learned so much. I mean, it was a really tremendously educational experience. And the greatest thing of it all was that I had it fully confirmed to me that this is all I want to do in life, is direct movies. Like, that was the big thing. That was the big takeaway. It's not some, you know, nerd fantasy of like, oh yeah, I want to make a movie and I want to be a big director and all that. It's like, I actually enjoyed the process, and I enjoyed the problems, and I enjoyed everything, the good and the bad. I miss it. You know, it's almost like I became addicted to the problem solving that you need to do on a like constant basis when you make a movie.
Do you see yourself? Do you have anything in the pipeline that you're going to work on?
I do. I actually have a few, and it's just whichever one gets the money first is the one I'll do. And that's tough these days. I mean, I have friends who are, you know, they're doing Kickstarters and Indiegogos, and they're just trying to get the crowdfunding way of getting their movies made. I mean, like today, for instance, my friends Rob Burnett and Alec Peters, they've got their Star Trek Axanar project that they've raised a ton of money for, but they're still not even close to the ultimate goal. And so it's not easy, but it is a way to go. I don't think that's going to be my route, because they're working with an existing franchise. I am working on original stuff for the most part. So usually people aren't that interested in original stuff, unfortunately. It's like they're more interested in branded entertainment these days. So I need to find an investor or some, you know, revenue source that has the vision and the bravery to do it. And I'm not talking about a lot of money. It's just like, but it is money that's needed to make the movie. And I, unfortunately, I'm not independently wealthy, and I can't pay for it myself. So that's kind of where we're at. But I've got like three or four projects, and I'm really excited about all of them. It's just which one will get the money will determine which one goes next.
Out of curiosity, all very cool. And hopefully one of the projects comes to fruition as soon as it can. Being that we're in such dramatically shifting, you know, times with technology, what's your opinion on film versus digital? And are you excited by the digital possibilities? Are you a film guy or both? Or,
you know, it's funny, I've had a lot of these conversations recently, mostly on the presentational side, that there seems to be a lot of 35 millimeter extremists lately that have become very militant about 35 millimeter. I've shot a music video on 35 one time. I love 35. I love film. I love digital. To me, there are far more important things to worry about than that. It's an important thing. Don't get me wrong. I mean, the camera you use, the lenses you use, the format, those are all important things, but they're not as important as the story and the characters and, you know, the overall experience. So I personally am a little more, I think, tolerant of digital than I think a lot of film purists are. But by the same token, it's like, I love film, and I would, you know, I would use film any chance I got. But there are, you know, there are different ways to look at it, especially when you come to the post-production side of things, where, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, film is the only way to go. And I think, well, film is the preferred medium to preserve your movie, basically. If you can preserve it on film, but then create, you know, a DI off of that you can then show in theaters as a DCP, as a digital print, basically, then you're not tearing up your film, you know, your actual photochemical product. Like, you have that on the shelf, preserved, protected for as long as you can, and you let the drive be the workhorse to show the movie, and it's the same. It looks exactly the same and sounds the same every single time because it's digital, you know. So I think that there's a middle ground to be, exploited, that I think some people are like either or, us versus them, and I'm definitely not one of those guys. I mean, and not to point the finger at anybody or anything, but like, I love the New Beverly Cinema, okay, and that's Tarantino's theater here in LA, and it's great, and I love going to movies there, and he's a 35 millimeter or a film purist, and like, they're showing his prints and they're showing pretty much only 35 millimeter films now. But the problem with that is, no matter how well preserved it is, there's still scratches, there's still discoloration, it's still fading. There are things that now begin to take you out of enjoying the movie because you're watching the scratches and you're watching the missing shots and you're watching the flaws of the print, that I think you should be immersed in the story and character first. And you might be looking at a film digitally, and it might be so crispy and pristine that a film purist might look at it and think, oh, that looks terrible. It looks like I downloaded it off YouTube. But I don't see it that way because, I mean, projection has gotten so good. I mean, you go to, like, the Chinese theater with the new 3D IMAX they have there, which I'm not a big 3D guy either, but you go there and you see films like, you know, Fury Road or Gravity or whatever, and it's super top-notch, and I'm immersed in the movie from beginning to end. I'm not thinking about what format it's on because it's perfect, you know? So that's a long answer to your question, but basically, I'm happy either way, but I also feel like the story and character need to take priority over what format you shoot on.
Yeah, I think you nailed it there. I mean, that's a slippery slope because I feel the same way, where it's like, I love film, but I mean, look at what people are doing digitally. And, you know, to take it a step further, I was resistant to the initial Blu-ray release. I was like, I like the way film looks. I like the way my DVDs look. It's like, this is becoming to look less and less like movies the way that I think they should be shown. And then I eventually, of course, I broke down and I bought a Blu-ray player, and I've been obsessed ever since. And my living space is just overflowing with Blu-rays right now. But, you know, and then to take it a step further, the Ultra Blu-rays are supposed to come out by what, Christmas? Or something like that, I was reading online.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I don't even know what to say. Like, 4K Blu-rays?
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Because, I mean, I just got a 4K TV and I love it.
And that's great. I mean, and that's you know, I again, it's sort of like, I wonder how many times the home entertainment industry can go back to the marketplace and say, here's the latest upgrade, after everyone just switched over from DVD to Blu-ray, and now they want to go from Blu-ray to, you know.
Right.
It's like, I just don't know how many times you're going to get that bite at the apple and not completely turn off people. I mean, they already are turned off. I mean, I mean the way the industry took a huge nosedive in 2008 when the economy tanked and people's sort of disposable income went away, that you can't just keep going back and asking people to spend more and more money because they don't have it anymore. And why not have that money go into software, into like the titles themselves, and not the next, you know, slightly better. And when I say slightly, I realize mathematically it's significantly better, but I think to the common human eye that the difference is negligible at this point. The jump from VHS and Laserdisc to DVD was big, but the jump from DVD to Blu-ray, I mean, it's big for someone whose eyes are attuned to it, but I think for most people it was not. And that's why Blu-ray didn't quite take off the same way DVD did. And now it's going to be even more, you know, nuanced.
Right.
So I think, the you know, the further you go into 4K.
Just stick with one thing. Yeah.
I mean,
if you can. I don't know. My hands are forced.
There's an overwhelming sense. And I agree. Like, it's just, how many times can you ask somebody to buy even your favorite movie 58 times on all these different formats? And, you know, I think that you're right. I think that Frank and I are big fans of physical media, which I know you would have to be, considering that that's your job. Physical media, I hope, never leaves, because I'm a huge fan of holding the movie in my hand and seeing the packaging and seeing the artwork or the job that somebody's done to put it together. It's part of that's part of the fun of loving movies is, you know, being able to hold it in your hand. So as much as streaming has come on and taken over and everybody's in love with streaming, and I haven't gotten onto the thing yet, in any real way, shape or form, my heart's always going to be with holding the disc.
I agree. I'm with you. I feel the same way.
Yeah. I mean, I that's how I am too. I mean, I love streaming for being able to see films that I can't see in Region 1. I mean, I haven't broke on through to buying a Region 3 or a Region 2 Blu-ray player. I know Nick did not too long ago.
Yeah,
but truly. I mean, there's no other way I could have watched a very long engagement other than renting it on Amazon's Instant Video or Vudu's streaming service. It's unfortunate, but, you know, at the same time, I think streaming has its advantages. That's how I saw Abel Ferrara's latest film, Welcome to New York, the unrated cut. I mean, that's coming out at the end of the month on Blu-ray, but it's been a long time for that on Blu-ray. But even for the Ultra Blu-rays, I mean, you know, people like us are kind of screwed because they're going to release this, and then they're going to, you know, the next Star Wars film, Episode 7, I read the tentative release date's supposed to be in April, and of course it's going to come out on Ultra Blu-ray or whatever it's going to be called, and there's going to be like a Blade Runner set that'll come out and an Alien set. It's just like I can't not stop now. I mean, I've owned Blade Runner and Alien and a bunch of other films all the way from VHS to some of them even on Laserdisc, which I still have Laserdiscs and watch them, to DVD and Blu-ray. It's just insane.
I still have all of my Laserdiscs too, and every once in a while I'll watch one because there's something on the Laserdisc that never transferred over to DVD or Blu-ray, you know. So, I mean, I archive as much as I can for the movies that I truly love. And I would just say, you know, just buy the product that you feel is worth your money. You know, I mean, there are certain titles, I won't mention their names, but I have not bought them yet on any home video format because they don't present the films the way I want them presented, you know. And it's got nothing to do with, you know, like how the filmmaker wants it to be seen, because he got that, it's out. But I mean, I have a particular memory for a certain series of films, the way they originally were, and I want one of those versions, you know. And I know you know what I'm talking about. And it's like, and it's fine. It's like people who want to buy it, great. And when they come out with the versions that I originally grew up with, I will buy those. I will buy.
Dude, you know Disney's going to release them.
Well, they can't for a while. Because Fox still has the rights for quite a few years, but Fox has the rights on the six of them until the year 2020, and then they have Star Wars forever in terms of distribution. So that's going to be an interesting deal that's going to have to get made if that ever happens.
Oh God! I mean, I do own those DVDs that came. I don't know if they're Best Buy exclusives, but they came out like 10 years ago. Were on the special features disc, were the theatrical cuts to the films. But they're really crappy transfers.
Yeah,
but I do have those.
They're off the I believe it's the 1994 Laserdisc Master. So
yeah,
they're definitely not state of the art even by DVD standards.
Yeah, well,
I want to ask you a quick question, Charles, because I noticed that it's finally coming out on Blu-ray, Ridley Scott's Matchstick Men, mm-hmm. which I've been like holding my breath for basically for the last like whatever for it to hit Blu-ray. I love the film. Is the Tricks of the Trade documentary going to make it over to the Blu-ray, or is there anything new on that one that maybe you can talk about? Or cause I know that it's already coming out. It's, you know, it's, you can pre-order it. So anything new on that or no? Was it just the port?
I first heard about that Blu-ray after it had been announced, so that should tell you I had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
I hope the Tricks of the Trade doc carries over, because that's one of my personal favorites. I mean, and that was actually the first one that Ridley let me document myself. I was at his offices in West Hollywood on his company RSA in the cafe area, and it was the day after Project Greenlight first premiered on HBO or whatever it was on. And he was talking about it, and at some point he leans over to me and he says, "Hey, did you watch Project Greenlight?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "How about we do a Project Greenlight type thing for Matchstick Men?" I said, "Great." And as it turned out, I had my video camera in my car, so I just started documenting that day, and I had complete access. And it's the first time I was ever allowed to, you know, really go deeply immersive in the behind-the-scenes process on one of Ridley's movies. And because it was just me with my camera, I got crazy amounts of access. So that's, I think that's one of my favorite docs, because it's so intimate and personal and kind of like fun, because you really are along for the ride on what was a pretty fun shoot. And it's honest too. So, unfortunately, you know, Matchstick Men's probably not a huge cash cow title, you know, that the studios want to keep throwing money at it to enhance things. We could, but I don't know if there's an audience for it or an appetite for it. I hope the doc, you know, carries over. But again, since I wasn't involved with the Blu-ray, I'm not sure what the status of it is.
I'm just so happy that it's finally coming out on Blu-ray. I think it's disgustingly underrated. For me, it's like top five Ridley. I think it's brilliant. The twists you do, you know, if you have never seen the film, you don't see them coming. I love the film. So, I also agree. I think that is one of your best docs that I've seen, you know, out of all of your efforts. It's wonderful. And like you said, there's an intimacy to all your stuff, which, you know, comes through whenever you do watch your stuff, which is always fun. I think I read somewhere in an interview or an article where you really like to be in the room with people doing the interviews and allowing a more, you know, personal relationship to build with the subject. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I usually conduct as many interviews as I possibly can. And, you know, with the and I operate the camera as much as I can. Sometimes it's not always possible, but you know, especially in the early days when I was kind of starting out, I shot absolutely as much as I possibly could, and I still do now. Except now the movies are so big that to run from one side of the studio lot to the other, it's just better to have another camera guy on the other side, you know, because sometimes you miss things. I mean, I remember on Prometheus, I was with Ridley and the art department, and they were going through all the props and all like the set decoration. And then Ridley comes over to me and says, "Hey, you know, we're shooting the engineers right now. We're doing engineer tests." And I'm like, fuck. I have to like run across all the way across Pinewood by myself with my camera to capture that. And at that point, I realized, yeah, it's better to like get the team together and let's just cover as much as we can so we don't miss anything. Because the old days of me, you know, running around with the camera, I think, the movies are too big now. Whereas Matchstick Men, it was easy because it was like a family making, you know, a movie. And it was easy to stick with the family. Whereas now it's more of like a military operation, and there's units all over the place.
Well, I'm probably speaking for Frank when I say it's just, you know, dream job style. It's like you can't imagine what it's like for people on the outside who love movies and, you know, to get a chance to hear these types of stories. I just, I can't imagine. You must feel like for me, it would feel like it's, you know, Christmas morning every morning or whatever, your birthday every day. I can't imagine that it wouldn't feel like that at times.
Yeah, this just sounds incredible.
Yeah. I mean, especially on the movies that you love, like the older films, to get to see things that you thought were lost or, you know, that people would never get to see. I mean, like with Aliens, the infamous Burke cocooned deleted scene, which, you know, I never thought we'd ever be allowed to put that on, but we did on the Blu-ray. And it's things like that, that when you know that people out there, that fans out there know it exists, and it's your job to try to get it to them. And when you do, that is really thrilling to like go online and read the reactions and to see people like freak out. Oh my God, we're finally getting it after all these years, you know?
Yeah. I freaked out over the initial briefcase or silver case Blade Runner DVD set because that came with so many prints of the film and it came with a theatrical cut. Now that was my first experience to Blu-ray. I remember being at my to Blade Runner. That was my first, I remember being at my grandparents' house, went to Blockbuster, and I rented Blade Runner, and it was the theatrical cut. And that was the only time I ever saw it, because when I got older and I was buying VHS and DVDs, I couldn't find the theatrical cut. And it was just the straight-up director's cut on VHS, the straight-up director's cut on DVD. And it was very cool to rewatch that now. And not too long ago, I bought the Blade Runner Digibook, the Blu-ray Digibook, which is very cool with the unicorn on the cover. And I think it's amazing how many different prints of that film got released for that set.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of my attempt at putting together what I think would be the dream set for, again, going back to another series of movies that have not been fully, taken care of. That would be my version of that, you know, is to give everybody every version they want, because then there's no argument. It's like, you know, fans are so invested in the films they love and the things they love. And when you deprive them of something they cherish so much and then ask them to buy, you know, the product over and over again, I feel like, why not give them what they want? And then everyone's, you know, unanimous in their love of the title. You know, I mean, there might be things they don't like about, you know, about things that have been put together for it, but their history with that title is now complete because they got that thing that they grew up with. And that's with Blade Runner. My goal was to give every type of Blade Runner fan the thing that they wanted, you know, with those five cuts of the movie.
And you've had a chance to work with, you know, with filmmakers who mean so much to major film buffs. You know, so it just has to be exciting to be a part of so many different projects that mean so much to so many people. And at the same token, be able to be an original voice all your own and getting a chance to, you know, tell your own story. So, you know, I can't thank you enough for coming on and chatting with us and, you know, telling us all about, you know, this side of the industry, this side of the business, which, you know, Frank and I have never had a chance to talk to somebody like you. So, it's truly a pleasure to get it, you know, to get a glimpse into this side of the world. And, you know, again, having seen so many of your documentaries throughout the years, this truly was very cool to get a chance to talk to you.
No, I mean, I'm glad you guys like the stuff and I really appreciate it. And I'm you know, I'm glad it just doesn't get released and then disappear into the ether. I'm glad people actually watch the stuff because, you know, we put a lot of work into them. And because I'm a fan, I usually try to create them for myself. And I think, well, if other people are fans, they'll like it too. So I'm glad that it's connecting with somebody.
Yeah, thank you enough for the Alien set and the Blade Runner set, among all your other stuff. But I mean, in particular, the Blade Runner set and the Alien set are my two favorite things I own.
Oh, man, thank you. That's great. I'm glad you like them.
Absolutely. And Charles, I just want to ask one question because it's relatively new, and I'm just curious to know if you've seen the new packaging that Warner Brothers has been doing with the Diamond Luge Blu-rays. Have you had a chance to see those yet?
I don't know if I have. Can you give an example of one of them?
Yeah, the Natural Born Killers. They put out a bunch. I have the Natural Born Killers. I've got.
Are these? I don't even know what that is.
Yeah, they're these new Blu-rays that Warner Brothers.
Go to Amazon.
They did one for Green Mile. They've done one for Natural Born Killers. I have a Batman. I believe Tim Burton's Batman.
Oh.
Also. And what they are is they're very similar in a way to your design for the Alien anthology set. They are magnetized backing, so there's no plastic, mm-hmm. and they're seamless, and the artwork stretches across it essentially.
Right.
If you've not seen one of these, I think that you'd get a kick out of this particular format. I don't think they've put out a ton. But
are they digibooks?
No, they're not. They're not digibooks, and it's kind of hard.
It's like the Interstellar packaging.
No, they feel like
things are. Jeez.
Yeah, they feel like high grade plastic, like very thick, dense plastic, or like almost like a PVC material. And when you open it up, it's shiny, extremely shiny, and they're really cool. I just wanted to throw it, you know, I don't know if you were familiar with these. The Natural Born Killers one and the Batman one are beautiful. So just, you know, keep your eye out for them. I think you'd get a kick out of the packaging.
Well, it seems like a lot of the studios are kind of revisiting their titles with new packaging that are almost sort of like Mondo style, you know, kind of minimalist or unusual alternate art. And I think because Fox has done a whole series of them, Sony just announced Dracula today, and maybe another film. And you know,
the Dracula coming out yet?
Yeah, and then and even Star Wars has a whole new set coming out of, you know, repackaged, you know, like the
Blu-ray steel cases.
There's a lot of that going on right now, and I think that's to, you know, tap into the geek collectors market because people love alternate art.
Listen, my wife is getting Blu-rays. Sorry, Frank, to tell you real quick. My wife's done with me getting Blu-rays, but even she says the diamond ones are, like, amazing and, you know, get as many as they've got because they're so cool looking. So definitely check them out.
Yeah, not to shit on Star Wars because that's, like, my favorite thing in the entire world. But it does piss me off what they do, and I was excited for the Steelbook cases. I was probably going to get some because I own all the DVD releases, and I have the Laserdiscs and VHS and the Blu-ray set. But what really made me mad was I knew that they weren't going to be the original theatrical cuts or unaltered cuts, but I was hoping that they were going to release digital copies, like a UV code, with them. And, of course, they don't because they want you to buy the digital package on Vudu or Amazon. So I haven't crossed that line yet to where I've bought the digital bundle for like $100 on whatever streaming.
Yeah, I mean
service,
that goes.
So. What was that?
Anyone, not just Star Wars, but anyone puts out a product.
Hello.
I think he's cutting. I think he might be cutting.
Oh,
I'm here.
Oh, it looks like Charles disconnected.
He might have had a bad connection.
I don't know if he's back or not.
Hey, we got cut off.
I think he's back.
All right. Are you there?
Yeah, we're here, man.
Yep, we're here.
Hello?
Can you hear us?
Are you there? I can hear you now.
All right, cool. Sure. Yeah, good thing it's not live. That's what I love. That's why I love podcasts.
Yeah. I don't even remember. I was just on a rant about, you know, back in the day.
Yeah, you were saying it's not just Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just Star Wars that I get, you know, this passionate about, but it is funny that to me that, like, Star Wars seems to be the lightning rod for these types of discussions, and I think it's just because, you know, fans have been deprived of the original versions. But if you think about it, there's so many versions now of each Star Wars film. It's not just the original and then the latest edition. I mean, there's like all of these different versions in between. So how do you, there'll always be someone that's unsatisfied unless you can find a way to author a disc to contain all the iterations of it over the years. So that's why I don't really get that annoyed anymore, because I realize film is like an organic beast that just continues to grow and evolve. And
right.
whenever they put out a product that I want, I'll buy it. And if it's not what I want, I won't buy it. And I'll spend my money on stuff that I want to buy. And the anger has gone away from me now. It's like I think it used to be anger. Now I'm like, well, you know, they do the best they can. We do the best we can. Everyone just does the best they can, and let's hope that sometime down the road we'll get what we want, you know. But I mean, to be like so upset about it seems like a waste of energy to me now.
I just wish they would release a set to where you could like make your own cut.
Yeah,
that would be very cool.
I mean, it might be possible. We tried that with Blade Runner, actually, to create a menu that would allow you to tailor the cut to your liking. And I think it was a little too robust in terms of the authoring that was required. But you would have been able to like turn the narration on or off, the happy ending on or off, the unicorn on or off. So, like, you would have had very like basic choices, and then you could have potentially created your own preferred cut. But it was just to squeeze three versions of the movie onto one disc, like we were doing, and then to add that on top of it, the QC with all the different players in the world and all the glitches that probably would have come up, it would have been a nightmare. So it was a good idea, but it was a little ahead of its time, I think.
Amazing idea, and honestly, just a further testament to the. I would assume that, you know, Ridley would have had to have been okay with that idea. You know, that's just so generous of him to say, here's a film that has gone through so many different cuts and permutations. I'm going to allow fans to even remotely think of making their own version of my movie, which, you know, I think that's wonderful. So, I guess a bummer that didn't happen.
I don't think he knew about it. We never got that far because we were going to talk about before I went to him. I mean, with Blade Runner, every time I went to him with something, we had already kind of like tried to figure out what it was before we went to him. And that was one of those we were just sort of experimenting before presenting him with that option. Like when it came down to the final cut, you know, the idea of going back in and reshooting Joanna Cassidy so we could replace her head in that scene where she dies, and it's obviously a stunt double. You know, originally Ridley was not interested in doing that. He kind of said no. He thought it'd be distracting, or it might, you know, look worse than the real thing. And then we just did it. And I had a very honest discussion with Warner Brothers about it, and we all agreed that if it sucked, we wouldn't include it. Even if we spent the money to do it, if it didn't look right, we wouldn't put it in the film. And it, fortunately, it looked great, and Ridley then suddenly was like, oh, yeah, that's amazing. I'll just keep that in the movie. So you kind of just have to get it together first and then present it, and then he'll either say yes or no, or you might have a discussion about it. But that custom editor thing was – and it was an idea that I had, and then I talked to Warner Brothers about how do we actually do it, and then it just got to be so complicated we didn't even bring it up with Ridley. But, you know, maybe down the road on some future release, who knows?
Very cool idea.
On the 4K Blu-ray.
Yeah. And, of course, by then there'll be a final cut, and then a final two.
Yeah, the executive final cut and everything else, but no. Well, thank you. Go ahead.
Really quickly, I do love, though, I mean, the democracy of editing that's happening, like on YouTube and Vimeo, and people editing their own versions of movies. It's fascinating.
Soderbergh cutting movies.
What's that?
Steven Soderbergh cutting 2001, Soderbergh cut.
Right. Or Soderbergh doing that version of Raiders that was black and white and had, like, synth music in it. These are really fascinating experiments, And when we're putting together Blade Runner, I intentionally included all these outtakes and extra bits of footage in the documentaries and deleted scenes, full well knowing people are going to cut it together. And I'm still waiting for that perfect, you know, all-inclusive cut. But I enjoy seeing people, you know, use their own, you know, their own vision and perspective on the work and use it creatively. You know, I mean, that's really fun to see.
Is there a film we close with this? Is there a film that you deep down inside you would love to be able to restore, refurbish, and put out a new special edition of? Is there like the, you know, the Charles special that you're always waiting for?
Well, I don't know about in terms of restoration at this point anymore. I mean, I would definitely love to do Star Wars without a doubt. Like that's number one easily. All the Star Wars films, but beyond that, I kind of feel like I've gotten to do the ones I really wanted to do, and now they're mostly new movies in the pipeline that, you know, I'm working on. The older ones, you know, unfortunately, again, the budgets aren't quite there like they used to be, and it takes a lot of work to go in and rework a movie or do new content and go out and interview people. I mean, it's not as easy as you might think. So it's you really have to pick your battles carefully now, because it's not like the old golden age of DVD where they were doing special editions for everything, you know, like Big Mama's House is getting a special edition. It's like, you can't really do that. So
director's commentary, Mama's House too. Fair enough.
Yeah, my dream would definitely be, I would love to be a part of Star Wars in some capacity. But beyond that, I'm happy, you know, I'm happy doing what I'm doing. And obviously, I'd like to just continue to try to keep the directing thing going and work on my own films.
Of course. Hey, man.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. This was a movie nerd's dream come true to talk to you about all this stuff. This was incredible.
Well, thanks for having me, man. I mean, I haven't really talked about this stuff in a while, so it's always nice to remind myself of what I've done, because it's a big blur now. I'm getting old, and it's a big blur. So thanks for focusing on me a bit.
Well, absolutely. Thank you again, Charles. Two big fans here for sure. And, you know, keep up the great work on all your projects. We look forward to seeing plenty more from you in the future.
Cool. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.
See you. Bye.
All right.
Bye.